Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Donald Trump has said his day one in office would include lifting roadblocks to the Keystone Pipeline, which he mentions by name, and in general to production of fossil fuels, including oil, shale, natural gas, and what he calls clean coal. Of course, there's a debate about whether there's any such thing as really clean coal. And he says he'll cancel payments to UN climate change programs on day one to use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. Trump has repeatedly called climate change a hoax. And the Paris Climate Agreement, which just went into effect last week, is now threatened by his election. He says he'll withdraw. Here with me now to help process what Trump's election might mean for the environment in general and the climate change issue in particular is Bill McKibben, the environmentalist, founder of the activist 350.org, which is dedicated to climate change issues, and the author of many books, including Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Hi, Bill. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you as always.
Are you reeling?
You know, don't blame me. I'm from Vermont. I spent a year out campaigning with Mr. Sanders, and we tried to tell people that this was what was coming down the pike. There's a lot of anger out there, and unfortunately, it took the unlikely form of a, you know, chubby, privileged billionaire from someplace in the canyons of Manhattan.
Listeners, your climate change and the Trump administration calls. Questions for Bill McKibben, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let me go down that list a little bit. These are things from the actual document that the Trump campaign released on his first 100 days and see how possible you think they are and, you know, what would actually be involved. So, for example, this is one people probably didn't hear about much until he announced that he would cancel it. The payments to the UN climate change programs to use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. What do we pay the UN for with respect to climate change?
The main thing that we've said is that we'll pay a small sum in the grand scheme of things, I think about $500 million a year to help poor nations leapfrog over the fossil fuel age and onto sun and wind. It's obviously the cheapest place in the world to do this and the most practical, not mentioning that it's also a moral necessity given that we were the ones who filled the atmosphere with carbon and started raising the temperature of the earth.
Is that part of the Paris Climate Agreement?
It is part of the Paris Climate Agreement. The Paris Climate Agreement, as some of us pointed out at the time, was an agreement without any enforcement mechanism at all. And that means that though Donald Trump can't literally pull the U.S. out of it on day one, it'll take, I think, 3 years legally to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accords. He can simply not spend any money doing anything about it. You know, our meeting our targets under the Paris Climate Accord predicated on following the Obama Clean Power Plan, and he's clearly not going to be doing that, not going to be doing a lot of other things. We won't come close to meeting our targets. So in real terms, he's withdrawing us from the Paris Accords.
He doesn't have an EPA administrator yet. It's too early for that. But I read that Trump does have a choice already to lead the EPA transition team, and that is Myron Abell, a well-known and proud climate change skeptic. Are you familiar with Myron Abell?
Yes, he's been at this work for a very long time, and he's been leading for months now the Trump energy climate transition team. So he'll doubtless have a all-star list of the remaining climate deniers, most of whom come from, in one way or another, the fossil fuel industry.
And it appears Trump will gut President Obama's domestic emissions regulations, which the president put into place largely because he knew he couldn't get any actual legislation through a gridlock Congress. This has been in the courts, as you know, and Trump considers it unconstitutional.
He'll be doing more than that. I think that there'll be there's a long Republican wish list, and it includes things like selling off the country's public lands, its national forests, to private industry. If you want to go drill an oil well in a national park someplace, now would be a good time to take out your application.
But on day one, because it was an executive action by President Obama, can Trump just flick his finger and, you know, sign a pen and undo the power plant emission rules?
That I don't know. I don't know how much of it is now encoded in statute, but he can do a lot. And if everyone knows that it won't be enforced, that there'll be nobody pushing them on it, it probably amounts to much the same thing.
Put on your headphones. We're going to take some phone calls. Leading climate change environmentalist Bill McKibben with us here in the studio at WNYC. Our lines are full. People really want to talk to you. And one of them is Alan in Manhattan. Alan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks very much for the chance to speak to you. On issues of trade and infrastructure, do you think there's a possibility Trump will have ways of achieving things indirectly that are favorable to climate change efforts without putting that label on it? In other words, one of the ways of combating climate change is to finally put a price on the carbon cost of shipping freight across 10,000 miles to and from China. Currently, that carbon cost is exempt even under the Paris Accords. And also on infrastructure, without focusing the attention on the fact that much of the infrastructure he could be in favor of would be solar and wind infrastructure in addition to traditional water, sewer, and road.
Yeah, interesting. So, do you think there's a point on that last thing that Alan said? Do you think there's a potential point of negotiation, or whatever the right word is, with Trump, since he says he wants a big infrastructure program, which, you know, that at least sounds more like a traditional Democratic agenda item? Could some of that be renewable energy infrastructure?
Well, it could. My guess is that people like Myron Ebell are making sure that it won't. But that said, among the very few things we know about Donald Trump, and we really don't know much because, you know, his mind is kind of a black box.
And he didn't run a very policy-oriented campaign.
But one of the things we know about him is that he likes building big things. Okay, that seems to be a clear part of his – consistent part of his character. The biggest thing, the biggest job, the only truly big job that the U.S. economy could conceivably have in front of it is the transition off fossil fuels and onto renewable energy. I wrote a piece this summer really with kind of this scenario in mind, saying the amount of jobs and economic activity you could produce across the upper Midwest, which is where Trump won his victory, by emulating what we did in the early days of World War II, except this time not with bombers and tanks but with solar panels and wind turbines, the numbers are astonishing. Were he serious about any of this, that's what he'd do. I have a feeling he's probably not that serious about any of it.
Another thing on his list is, well, Keystone. What's the status of Keystone?
Well, Keystone at the moment is dead, but it will likely spring back to life. It'll take them a while to decide if they want to build it again. The investors, they may have a little bit of trouble finding eager investors, but out of pure spite, they may decide to build it. The more pressing pipeline fight at the moment, the one that'll come first in line, is what's going on in the Dakotas right now. Where the Sioux Nation and 200 other Indian tribes are at a remarkable encampment at the confluence of the Missouri and Cannonball Rivers, trying to block a pipeline under that river. At the moment, we'd settle for the Obama administration doing the right thing in its last 70 days in office, and there'll be big rallies and across the country in more than 100 cities on November 15th to ask the Army Corps of Engineers for once not to screw Indian nations. But even if we win it in the Obama, you know, in the Obama epilogue, whether or not it'll last is an open question. But these are the things around which one has to organize so that people at least understand what's at stake. Even most people in Trump's America feel shame for what we've done to Native Americans over the last 400 years. Anyone who doesn't has no moral character at all. And so this is a very important place to be fighting.
And that happens to intersect at Standing Rock with fossil fuel infrastructure.
Exactly right.
Susan in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hello. My question is, what the hell do we do now?
You could be every caller on every segment right now.
Well, look, I don't have by any means all the answers, and I'm as stunned in certain ways as anybody else. Though, as I say, having spent a year with Bernie, I had a sense of some of what was out there. I think that actually Bernie plays a big role in the weeks ahead. He's the most popular politician in America. It's very clear that the Democratic Party, if it's going to exist in a meaningful way in the future, has to be completely restructured. The idea of the D.C. establishment elite doesn't work for anybody.
What do you mean by he's the most popular? Because even not to replay the primary, but
if you look at his polling numbers, his favorability numbers, he's 10 points ahead even of Barack Obama.
Huh.
Okay. He's the one politician in America that everyone really trusts, mostly because he's the one guy who's been saying the same thing over and over again for 30 years. Believe me, if you live in Vermont, you've heard it many, many times.
So what can he do?
Well, I think job one is figuring out how to restructure the Democratic Party so that it's actually a party of the people, not of the kind of Hillary Clinton inside elite D.C. thing that, as it turns out, people just really hate. And I think the second thing is he and Elizabeth Warren and a few others are going to have to be a kind of visible moral power center in the Senate. They're not going to be able to stop things from happening most of the time, but they're going to have to make the strong, loud, profound case. Remember, Trump has great legal powers now and can do an enormous number of things. What he can't do, one of the ways we fight him is to change the zeitgeist in this country. And if we do, if people begin to wake up what's going on, if people begin to be upset by it, then it's not that his legal authority diminishes, but some of his room for maneuver begins to diminish. And so that case is going to have to be made hard and regularly. And I was pleased to see the statement that Bernie issued yesterday. We said, we'll work with Mr. Trump as long as he's willing to do the things he was talking about, help working people, whatever. But the minute that his racism, his sexism, his anti-environmentalism impinges on that, we're going to stand and fight.
Raya in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. He actually answered my question very well. I feel like I don't know what to do. I don't know how we can act. 7 in 10 Americans believe climate change is real. So if Trump, he loves to be loved, he loves the adoration of people. So how can we convince him that if he helps us on climate change, then that's the good thing to do? That's how the people will be behind him. A lot of his supporters must believe climate change is real. If 7 in 10 Americans believe it's real, what can we do? How can we show him that it's serious?
The only way to demonstrate to politicians that you care about something is to be active on it. And, that's begun to happen. It took we were able to get nothing out of President Obama in his first administration on climate change. Then people took to the streets. 400,000 people marched memorably through the streets of New York, the biggest demonstration New York has seen in decades. And that began to turn President Obama around. He became an effective climate president, or at least more effective in his second term. Trump will be harder, but I do think that the caller, that Raya, makes a very good point. One of the other things we know about this guy is he's vain. And, a constant appeal to his vanity to be the protector of people and of the country against what is clearly its biggest threat. And remember, one of the things about climate change is we have it's not a static argument. Mother Nature will continue to provide an endless series of teachable moments. Some of those teachable moments will be very profound. The place where the Bush administration finally lost its mojo was with Hurricane Katrina. and the inept response to that. One imagines that there'll be similar episodes sooner rather than later.
Do you think there's anything to work with? And Raya, thank you for your call. Call us again. Anything to work with in, for example, this statement from the first 100 days agenda that says cancellation of payments to UN climate change programs to use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. So a suggestion, at least, even though it's from this nationalist America First context of, well, I don't want to give money to other countries to develop their infrastructure. I want to use that money at home. He does say use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. And he has been said to care about clean water as an environmental issue.
Flint,
as a starting point for something?
It could be. Flint seems to be the only issue on which every person running for president agreed, because how could you not? It's actually not okay to have poison water flowing through the faucets of Americans. We spent 100 years building the fantastic water supply system so that we wouldn't need Trump brand bottled water for people. So, that would be a perfectly good thing to be spending some time and attention on, and he'll get no argument from anyone if he spends some serious money rebuilding our water infrastructure. Among other things, it would provide jobs to precisely the people that we really can't afford to have building oil pipelines.
Justin in East New York. You're on WNYC with environmentalist Bill McKibben. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Brian. Love your show. Mr. McKibben, great respect for your work. And my question is regarding whether we can take a silver lining out of Hillary Clinton's defeat in that it may push the Democratic Party to make its next nominee someone who does not engage in the policy position of fracking as a transitional fuel, and push them towards a nominee who backs the keep it in the ground rhetoric. And to that end, are you familiar with Kanye West's position on fracking? Kanye 2020? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much.
I haven't had a chance to sit down with Kanye and discuss fracking yet. The caller makes a good point. You know, Bernie named me.
A text, by the way, from a college student who said something to the effect of, let's see how much we can prevent Trump from ruining the country until Kanye 2020 is the next president. So this is going around.
Okay, good. Good to know. Bernie named me as one of his five people to get to write the platform of the 15. So I, for the first time, got to see what the Democratic Party sort of looked like a little bit from the inside. And the caller picks just the right issues. These were the places we couldn't get the Clintons to budge, mm-hmm. Was around fracking and keep it in the ground stuff. On other things, we were able to persuade them to make at least some changes. But these are things that the Democratic core and base deeply cares about. And there are a lot of people willing to go to work on this stuff. We saw what happened in New York, across upstate New York, you know, across as red a New York as there is, when fracking was the issue.
It was Cuomo entirely banned fracking in New York State. Clinton's position was not that. Bernie said, ban it nationally. She said she wanted to look at a case-by-case basis scenario,
yep.
And that there would probably be few cases, but fracking would seem, you know, both energy productive and environmentally safe.
She wanted to hedge, which was turned out to be the problem.
Do you think, though, that if Trump is generally pro-fracking, that an incremental approach might be useful at this point? I'm not talking about as a candidate to run against them someday.
Better than me.
I'm just asking in terms of pointing out particular situations.
Sure.
Look, you can't do it here. You can't do it
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
And then it establishes some baselines.
One of the jobs of the environmental movement over the next little while, because remember, for a while, Trump's going to be riding high and completely powerful and popular and stuff. One of our jobs is just merely going to be paying careful attention and bearing witness to those dumb things that get done in order to build precisely the kind of narrative that we need to change things around. And, you know, the caller said maybe there's a silver lining there. There really isn't a silver lining in that this is going to be an intensely bad 4 years. It comes at the worst time for the climate change stuff, just when we were beginning to get a little bit of head of steam on clean energy, and now we've hit not a pothole but a ditch, you know. But the silver lining, if there is one, is it should get people to understand that we need real action, not rhetorical action. Rhetorical action didn't win the election.
Climate change did not come up in any of the presidential debates. There were exactly zero questions on the environment at all. Are you shocked by that?
If I told you I was shocked, I'd be lying, because it's been hard work to get anyone to pay attention. The only good news is that Mother Nature will continue to hit us upside the head until we do.
Talk for just a minute before you go about one of the heroes of the environmental movement, Jonathan Schell. Bill will be speaking tonight, you Bill McKibben fans, but I gather it's sold out, but we'll just announce that this is going on at the Tishman Auditorium at the New School at 7 o'clock on the fate of the Earth. And some of you know that was the title of the iconic book by Jonathan Schell.
So, Jonathan was a great hero. This is the first what will be an annual series of lectures. He died last year. When I first arrived at the New Yorker as a young man, Jonathan had just published The Fate of the Earth. It was the book that freed me up 7 or 8 years later to write the similarly portentously titled The End of Nature, which was the first book about climate change. His was about nuclear war. These are the two places where we understand that humans have grown so large that they can affect everything on the planet, and it means that we have to be ready to resist, and we are.
Bill McKibben, thank you very much.
Thank you.